It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Jewish Film Festival is a cultural event that is growing in popularity in the city. And after last night's Pittsburgh premiere of the gripping Holocaust-based drama Aftermath, it wouldn't be hard to come up with something that would be considered lighter fare. And tonight at the Manor Theater, J-Fest has just that, a comedy created by a couple of CMU grads called Blumenthal. It's the story of a now-deceased playwright played by Scottish actor Brian Cox, who is seen only in a TV interview taped before his death. A nephew is left to figure out how he feels about his complicated uncle. Here's a clip from the film.
Children are a blessing. I've always believed that. Children are a blessing.
And yet you've no children of your own.
No.
Ethan Blumenthal? Oh my God, I just read about your uncle. I am so sorry.
It's fine, really, it's nothing.
While watching his own play.
Yeah, laughing at his own joke. He was a prick.
If you've lost your only brother and the only thing you seem capable of feeling is constipated.
This award they gave your uncle, I think this will help me.
Where is it?
Hello? We all mourn differently. I cry alone.
Yeah.
That's from the movie Blumenthal, and I'm joined now in Studio A by the two CMU grads who made the film. Seth Fisher plays Blumenthal's nephew, Ethan. Mr. Fisher also wrote and directed the movie. Seth Fisher, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And also joining us is the producer of Blumenthal, Alexander Sendis, who also stars in the movie. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So in a way, this movie is like Citizen Kane in that the But you haven't heard that comparison yet, have you?
Keep going.
In we'll that you have the title character is dead, but he's left behind all these sound bites, and in the end, everybody's trying to figure out who he really was. How did you come up with the idea, Seth?
Right. Well, I think that's what fascinated me the most is, I remember, for instance, when Paul Newman died, all of a sudden, all of these old interviews were airing on TV, and he had done a few movies close to the time of his death, but all of a sudden it was like he was alive again. And I thought that was sort of interesting how, to a certain extent, the months right after somebody passes away, and in some ways they're more alive than they've ever been, certainly with anybody that features prominently in pop culture. And specifically, the idea of this, fictional playwright and his family, I spent a lot of time working as an actor in New York City, and I was lucky enough to work with some, pretty well-renowned people. But, I often wondered, what would it be like to be their less talented brother, or what if your last name, was Spielberg, but you weren't Steven, and that could probably be a burden to some people, and I thought it would make for some good comedy.
And Alex, there's the brother in this film, the Ethan's dad, is a writer also, and he teaches as well. So you've got – he's trying to figure out – he's ambivalent about his brother, and he's trying to sort through his feelings, as is Ethan. And I summed up the story, but how would you characterize the story that's at work here?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit about dealing with familial envy, as well. I mean, Saul is living in the shadow of his older brother. He's stymied at the time of his brother's death by what he's seen his brother accomplish and by what he feels like he hasn't accomplished. So his arc throughout the story, which is probably the central arc, is to watch him find some sort of, catharsis with the fact that his older brother has some of the acclaim that he wishes he had, and I mean that's where the story turns.
That's the heart of it.
Yeah, and he's also dealing with the fact too that he feels that his brother has taken aspects of his own.
Without giving too much away.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. But I don't think it's too much to say that he thinks that his brother drew so literally from his own life and his own experiences that he's somehow entitled to some of the acclaim. I am a big fan of Philip Roth's work, and so many of his early novels ended up plaguing him in his personal life, because everybody thought that every character was based on them. And, you know, he sort of walked around saying, guys, this is a story. Just because there's a mother in this doesn't mean it's my mother. And, you know, to a large extent, it's a huge testament to the quality of his writing. But I think that enhances Saul's sort of indignation towards his brother.
Now, there is a lot of Jewish-American male angst in this movie. Explain how or why that becomes an overriding theme, particularly with your character of Ethan, Seth.
You know, I don't know that it was ever such a conscious decision. And I know that sounds funny, seeing as the character articulates almost those words exactly. I think that particular character uses it as a crutch. I think my sense is that in this day and age, all of us have a good deal of that sort of judgment in place of pure experience. We are constantly assessing something. Is this good enough? Is this what I'm entitled to? Am I entitled to more? Should I have accomplished more? Can I do better? Could my spouse be better? Is this the right, you know, match for me? And Ethan in particular uses this sort of, you know, I guess legacy of Jewish neurosis as an excuse and a crutch. And, you know, there is a theme, but I think it's actually pretty universal now. And I've been, surprised at how universally people sort of respond to that, you know, tendency. Certainly younger people nowadays, when shopping for a partner, for lack of a better phrase, we are all hypercritical and we expect the best, and we sometimes focus too much on whether or not something is right for us, as opposed to just having an experience.
And do we hear more, with your character, you're at one point, you pick up a girl in a bar and you're trying to sort through, as you are with all the women in your life, you're trying to sort through how you feel about her. But there's this, well, she's not even Jewish. So does that come up more in Jewish culture, that where you're looking at, whether your potential partner shares the same beliefs?
It does come up. I mean, I think, you know, to varying degrees, depending on one's sort of personal, feelings on an interfaith relationship, you know, that is a very real thing and sort of its own subject. I think, though, it's a really sort of more concrete articulation of the excuses that we make. You know, one could say, okay, that is a fair excuse to say, hey, you know, this person is from a different background and they don't want to raise children the same way as me. And those are all sort of justifiable concerns, whether or not you're talking about interfaith. If you met somebody and you really wanted to have children and that person said, I love you too, but I don't want to have children, that's a deal breaker. So, you know, so there's many things like that anybody encounters in a relationship. And instinctively, I think we look for crutches. We look for excuses because we're so busy analyzing it and assessing it instead of just having the relationship. And I think with all the characters in the film, if there's any, sort of hope I had for the story and for these characters, was that we would leave with optimism that they would start actually having these experiences and stop judging them and just continue to live.
Alex, is there a cultural underpinning in place here, influenced maybe by Woody Allen, possibly by Jerry Seinfeld, where you have this title character who is a pompous ass who's in fact hiding a secret, which I won't give away, and and the somewhat self-loathing Ethan?
I mean, I'd probably not intentionally. I think if we shot a movie in New York that I think looks very beautiful.
Which this is.
Yeah, yes. Which this is. And so I think that inevitably draws comparisons. And there are Jewish people in the film, and it draws comparisons to Woody Allen. But in terms of the neuroses, I mean, in terms of Ethan's neuroses, I think it boils down more to what these people want from one another. You know, and there's like the character I play in the film, for example, is Ethan's best friend, who I think is one of the two characters in the film that is sort of looking at things from an outside perspective. He might have these problems in his own life, but constantly he's saying to Ethan, you know, things don't always have to be like incredibly great or incredibly awful. There's a middle ground. You know, stop being so critical and look at what you have, because you're going to have problems with everybody. If it's not this problem, it'll be another.
And even at the same time, you know, Alex's character, Isaac, is quite literally diagnostic. He is a pharmaceutical rep and is constantly trying to solve problems by sort of prescribing whatever
he
has in his bag.
You want some free samples?
Yeah, exactly. So he thinks he's got the answer for everything.
Wants to give them desperately, yeah, wants to help.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's another thing. I think, you know, that's a very sort of literal version of the things we've been talking about. You know, all of us go on WebMD and try to solve our life problems.
To your question, don't get me wrong, we'll take any comparisons to Woody Allen, absolutely. I mean, I think we're both big fans of his films.
Well, I guess I'm kind of looking at the influence here. If that's not it, what might it have been?
I think the influences are pretty broad. I love Woody Allen. I'm trying to remember if I was watching anything in particular when I was writing this. You know, there were certain things. The film does feature quite a few long, wide takes, which is sort of Manhattan-esque, which that was certainly a conscious decision. But as far as the sort of inspirations, not so much for the story. The story just sort of happened because it's theater and it's New York. If it's about a theater family, it's probably going to be in New York. And if it's about a theater family in New York, you know, if you rattle off, you know, 10 American playwrights in the last, you know, 50 years, a lot of them are going to have Jewish names or legacies, whether it's David Mamet, Arthur Miller, Neil Simon, you know, Sondheim, everything. There's just a lot of – it's sort of inevitable, you know, to a certain extent. But as far as people that, you know, I personally drew inspiration from in the writing of it, I would say David Mamet, the Coen brothers – sort of hyperverbal characters that, you know, talk as much as they act.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the movie Blumenthal, which is premiering, has its Pittsburgh premiere tonight at the Manor Theater. We're talking with writer-director and star Seth Fisher, and also a producer and a co-star Alexander Sandis. They are both CMU grads. And how important was it, Alex, to get a great actor like Brian Cox to play Blumenthal? He's one of those great character actors that you might not recognize the name, but you certainly would recognize the face. He shows up in films like The Bourne Identity, X-Men, The Rookie. He played Hermann Göring in Nuremberg. So he's this larger-than-life actor, and you managed to get him in this film.
Super Troopers.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was massively important and very helpful. I think Seth mentioned before, it was a pre-existing relationship of his. And actually, a lot of things pivoted around him, also with the involvement of his wife, the wonderful Nicole Ansari Cox, who came on as a producer and also plays the role of Fiona in the film. And, you know, that led to the connection of several other actors and gave us, I think it's fair to say, a certain amount of weight, because Brian's a guy that believes in Seth and Seth as a person and as an artist and as a writer, and read the script and was like, absolutely, anything I can do to help. And it was a huge, huge boon for us, because first-time filmmakers, young guys in New York, we needed that. And he was just a gentleman.
And Seth, what was it like? You acted with him on stage, but then now here you are doing so on film, but you're also directing him.
Right.
So describe how you're doing all this, and what is it like to be behind the camera and you're looking at the film one way, then you have to step in front of the camera and basically block all that out so that you can be in the moment, right?
Right. Directing Brian was probably the most nervous that I was throughout the whole process. You know, I remember going to set and thinking, had meals in this guy's house, but I'm going to tell him how to play this scene. You know, like it was, for some reason, that was really daunting to me. But after the first take, and, you know, inevitably you know, the director's going to have an opinion. That all went away, and he was just, you know, as I knew he was from working with him before, just great to work with. And, you know, every idea that you had, he would, you know, take the note and then top it. And then, I mean, we shot so much of him, more than actually we could fit in the movie. But he's just terrific. And, you know, he looked at me as he would look at any other director, which was great. And I think you know, just also helped make me feel more comfortable. As far as sort of getting behind the camera and getting in front of the camera.
Yeah, how do you manage that? Do you compartmentalize? What do?
You do. You sort of just take every, you know, take it minute by minute. In general, of all of the sort of different hats that you wear in a situation like this, the most sort of tedious thing that you have to do is get into wardrobe and get on camera. There were times where we were, you know, shooting scenes, and I didn't quite know what our schedule was for the next shot. And then Alex would walk over to me and he'd say, you know, Seth, you got to go get in the makeup chair. And you know, I was unshaven and in torn t-shirt, sweaty, and all of a sudden I had to care what I looked like and put on a suit. But you end up having to depend on a lot of people. You get a common question in this scenario of how do you do it by yourself? How does if you're going to be in it and also direct it, how do you do that? And the truth is, a lot of people do it. A lot of people help you do it. When I'm in front of the camera, I depend on people like Alex, who I've known for a long time and trust creatively to sort of guide me if I go astray. And everybody else, from actors to your cinematographer, Zach Mulligan, who shot this, he and I had worked quite a bit together in pre-production, so we knew what we were going after. And you just – it's trust. It really is.
Now, I have to ask you both before we wrap this up, what about your CMU education helped you in making this movie?
Alex?
CMU asked me to ask. No, I
didn't. Well, we were talking about so much. You know,
everything.
We were talking to some of the students that are coming out this year, yesterday, about this. I mean, I on one level, it's just a broad spectrum of understanding every aspect of storytelling. You know, there's certain things from the first year that you learn, and you're there, and you're like, oh, text to stage and all this stuff. Like, I don't need this. I just want to get on a stage. That we find, you know, I find 8 years later we're making a movie and I'm like, that's right, I know this because I remember Jed Harris was talking about this aspect of this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing was the multitasking, you know, being able to sort of – like we were sort of pushing – I was using the analogy yesterday. We had this spaceship we wanted to get into orbit, so we like got it into orbit and then we had to go inside and run the spaceship and then run back outside and keep it in orbit consistently. And to be able to do that, we had to come to it with some sort of facility, which were things that we pulled from Carnegie Mellon, I think, for sure.
Yeah, and it's funny because we often get the question, where did you go to film school? And the answer is we didn't go to film school. We went to drama school, which, you know, that doesn't teach you technically how to, you know, look at a camera. But, you know, that's, you know, in my opinion, much, you know, that's a literal technical thing that you can find a YouTube video to show you how to do. Not to, you know, be reductive about that, but I'm actually very into my cameras. But yeah, once you know all the things that you need to know, when you've said the words, when you've wrestled with a character and tried to figure out how to make things play and objectives, then all of that stuff becomes sort of second nature when you're writing and shooting something.
Are you a little nervous about, you know, the big premiere tonight in your old stomping grounds?
It's exciting. You know, that was the theater. We went to the Manor when we were in college here. So it's almost feels like a nice homecoming more than anything else. So no nerves. It's all good.
Wonderful piece. It's a very nostalgic and in a beautiful, like, heartfelt, warm way. It's just – it's great. It's really great.
Well, we've been talking about the movie Blumenthal with its writer, director, and star Seth Fisher and producer and co-star Alexander Sandis. They are both CMU grads. And the movie Blumenthal premieres tonight. Its Pittsburgh premiere is tonight at the Manor Theater in Squirrel Hill as part of J-Fest.
And it's also available now on demand on iTunes and DirecTV and cable and wherever you can click on a film.
There you go. Seth Fisher, Alexander Sandis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll discuss the misconceptions associated with dyslexia. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.